Why has the plight of the Rohingya been ignored? Hundreds of thousands of people fled a military crackdown in Myanmar 5 years ago. They've been refugees in Bangladesh ever since, with no hope of returning home. So what future do they have? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Tom McRae. On Thursday, more than 1 million Rohingya refugees marked 5 years since they were violently driven out from Myanmar. Most are still stuck in what's become the world's largest refugee camp in neighbouring Bangladesh. They're demanding a safe and dignified return to their homeland and a future for the thousands of children born in exile. But their chances of going home anytime soon are uncertain. Last year, the same army that expelled the Rohingya overthrew Myanmar's elected government. Now, fighting between rebels and the army has intensified in the Rohingya's home state of Rakhine. Well, almost a million mainly Muslim Rohingya are sheltering in Bangladesh. Myanmar denies them citizenship, making them one of the world's largest groups of stateless people. More than half are children. Aid agencies say they're at risk of becoming a lost generation because of a lack of education. 48% are women and girls, many of whom have survived or witnessed some form of gender-based violence. And conditions in the refugee camps are dire. Authorities say crime has increased, including violence, drug dealing and human trafficking. Well, we'll bring in our guests in just a moment. But first, this update from Tanvir Chowdhury in Cox's Bazar.
For refugees, life here is challenging. Overcrowded and fragile shelters surrounded by barbed wire fences, banned from formal education, work and travel. Refugees say they're frequently harassed by police and camp authorities. Violence, trafficking, child marriages and drug-related crimes are increasing inside the camp. Azra Khatun fled to Bangladesh in 2017. She has three children. Two of them were born in the camp. She is worried about their future.
We had enough. We want to go back home to Myanmar soon so that our children can get some education and have a normal life.
Bangladesh says it has done more than enough and it's time for the UN and global community to deal with the plight of the refugees.
We have been here for 5 years already. If we have to stay here longer, in that case, the United Nations, Bangladesh government and other organizations should find a new strategy to send us back soon.
Nearly 4,000 Rohingya refugees live along the border with Myanmar at Tumru in what's called no man's land. Conditions are harsh and they're cut off from the others.
Behind me is the only refugee camp in the no man's area. Most of it is in the Myanmar side. The rest is in the international boundary.
Conflict in Myanmar's Rakhine state is gradually spilling over close to the border.
We are unable to go to our own country still. Another fear we have now is due to frequent clashes between Arakan Buddhist rebel insurgents and the Myanmar army. It is getting very close to our camp area. We can hear artillery rounds and machine gun fire almost every day. Our children and families are in panic.
5 years on since the Rohingya arrived here, the UN Refugee Agency says they now face a protracted crisis and need help urgently.
So I think the main challenge is providing the support for them to survive on the day-to-day basis. The humanitarian needs are covered, but also moving towards what is going to happen next.
Many Rohingya refugees feel increasingly frustrated that they have little say in decisions about what happens to them, and that their fate and destiny appear to be at the mercy of others. Tanvir Chowdhury, Al Jazeera, Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
Well, let's bring in our guests now. In London, we have Chor Nguyen, Executive Director at the Burma Human Rights Network. In Vancouver, Yasmin Ulla, a Rohingya human rights activist. And in Cape Elizabeth, Maine in the US, Tom Andrews, the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Myanmar. A warm welcome to each of you. Thank you very much for being on the program today. Yasmin, I want to start with you. 5 years on, does it feel like anything has changed or have things simply gotten worse?
Unfortunately, things have gone worse. I think the segment by Tanvir was very, very captivating and very much true to what the sentiment is like on the ground. People are extremely worried that their situation's not going to ever get better. Neither would it get better in Rakhine State due to the junta's doing, and neither would it get better in the camps where restrictions are increasing in order to push people to go back home in an unsafe conditions. And so our communities are basically stuck in the in a limbo. And without any choices of our own, our agency completely ignored and our skills completely, you know, really just neglected and not incorporated in the plans and management of the camps.
Chua, do you think that there's a feeling of helplessness among the population at the moment?
As you see, the Rohingya population in the camp, they are genocide survivors. They are traumatized people. And then, besides, they have lots of pressure, you know, social pressures and authorities, for pressure from the authorities, local authorities, and also local communities. They are surrounded by lots of problems and difficulties. And this is the layers of failures by the international community, including UN. And that's the result we have today.
Mm. Tom, we've heard and seen quite a lot about the, you know, conditions in the refugee camps, but obviously there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Rohingya still in Myanmar. What is it like for them there, and has it just gotten worse since the military took power?
Well, Tom, that's a very good question, and yes, things are getting unfortunately worse inside of Myanmar. There are over 600,000 Rohingya living in Rakhine State right now. I spoke with some of them as recently as yesterday, and I can tell you from my conversations, things are bad and they're getting worse. There's no respect whatsoever for human rights. Conditions are horrible in terms of the bigotry and discrimination that they face. Restrictions in movement are even greater than ever before. More than 130,000 are living in what are called IDP camps. They're really concentration camps, if you will, open air prisons. I've been there. And, you know, 5 years ago when I was doing a fact-finding mission before I became Special Rapporteur, I was meeting with people there, and one man, I'll never forget him, he said, look, if the world won't help us, then bomb us, bomb the camps, because it would be better for me and my family to die than it would be to continue to live in these conditions. This is 5 years ago. So the fact is that this grim milestone that we have marked, the fifth anniversary, was not the beginning of the living hell that Rohingya men, women, and children have been suffering. It's been going on for some time, and it continues to go on in the current state in Myanmar, even as we speak.
Yeah, we'll get to the lack of response from the international community shortly. But just while we're speaking about these camps and the plight of the people within them, education in the last few months has been a massive issue. Yasmin, can you tell us a little bit about what has changed in the last 5 or 6 months in terms of educating young people in Cox's Bazar?
Yeah, I know for a fact that our community has done a lot of work to uplift ourselves. And a lot of these informal schools have been run mainly by donations within the community. And, you know, however much we can muster and get together, we actually send back home. But we actually have been seeing the dwindling ability to actually transfer the funds inside Cox's Bazar to the people that we're working with. On top of that, many different, you know, access that we used to have are actually closed down. And then we find out that informal schools are actually no longer allowed or permitted. It was sort of ignored, neglected for a very long time that we did this, as long as it doesn't mimic any curriculum that can work in the Bangladeshi curriculum. And now we just have a situation where authorities of humanitarian organizations are the ones that actually tip off Bangladeshi authorities to actually come and close down these informal schools. And now the people are in the camps are actually really feeling helpless because they don't know where to send their children. The informal schools that we have were by no means, you know, helpful or not necessarily helpful, but more so that it was not sufficient in any sense, but it was enough to actually get people to see the prospect, to actually hope for the future. But in this case, when all the schools are closed down, and in connection to that, we have rallies of people being told to actually say that they want to go back home regardless of the situation, there is connection there where education is no longer accessible. And here we have a group of people saying that they're going to go home regardless of how the conditions might be. Mm. It's just mind-boggling how things are developing and really worsening at this point.
Yeah, Chua, I see you nodding your head along to those statements there. With half of these camps made up of children, what does a lack of education on such a large scale mean to the future of these people? You know, are you concerned that there's going to be a lost generation created through this?
Yeah, first of all, we would like to thank Bangladesh for saving the life of the Rohingya people, but not allowing them for the education is killing their souls. Look at that population, 52% of the population is the young people, those who are school age, and they are not allowed to go to schools, and they don't have any, they are not, even young Rohingya youth, you see that the way they have training, giving the education to the children, it is very remarkable, and really salute them, you know, the way they have come stand up for the community, but then also prohibited by the Bangladesh government. And from the human rights perspective, it is a crime. You are not allowing young generation to for education, and that means you are destroying the community for their future in a long-term damage that going to cause. And Bangladesh will be the first country who will going to face the problem because they are there. They are there now. Mm. Practically, they are there now. And as long as the Burmese military or government or any not the opportunity to have to repatriation, they will be there forever. You know, Bangladesh government, how many decades they have been struggling for, you know, diplomatically to send them back to Burma. It has failed. So there must be alternative way. But until they go back, they're able to go back, they are there. So they need to stand up on their own. The education is the most important and the backbone of the community to stand up on their own. So Bangladesh government need to consider seriously to allow their schools, and not only informal, formal schools as well. And let the international community also raise this concern with the Bangladesh government.
Tom, just on the Bangladesh government, you know, 5 years ago, I imagine that they never thought that they would still have a million refugees living within their country in these sorts of conditions. Has too much pressure and responsibility been put on that one country? And what can be done about it at this point in time?
Well, there's an enormous amount of pressure on the Bangladesh government, and frankly, there's not enough has been done to support them by the international community. There's no question about it. Now, you think about it. Bangladesh is a developing country, a lot of challenges that they're facing. Of course, the world is facing a very difficult economic period right now. They have a lot on their plate. Add to that more than 1 million people who they welcomed into their country to save their lives, literally running for their lives. And now they're faced with an enormous, enormous challenge of how to deal with this enormous responsibility without adequate support from the international community. So I think it's really, really important. Now, all the points that Yasmin and Charwin are making are very, very important. And what Bangladesh needs is obviously voices to be heard from inside those camps. We need to listen and be responsive to those voices. But also they need support and engagement to a much greater degree from the international community. They deserve our thanks, but more than that, they deserve our support.
Do you feel that, you know, this plight of a million refugees is getting attention at the moment because it's a significant anniversary 5 years on? But do you think that a lot of it is a lot of talk, but not much action? Yasmin, how do you feel that the international community has responded to the plight in the last 12 months or so? Do you think it's been forgotten?
I unfortunately think that it has been. A lot of times there is this curious trend within the international community when it comes to dealing with the Rohingya cause or the Rohingya plight. it always acts as if Rohingya issue is separated from the Myanmar issue. And there we have it. We have the coup and the widespread violence across the country because the international community has actually ignored the concerns that were voiced by the Rohingya community and leadership. And now we are stuck in the middle of the issues of human insecurity and various other restrictive livelihood and, you know, apartheid-like conditions within Rakhine State and the mob, and the penalization of mobility within Rakhine State and across Myanmar for the Rohingya. All of this is basically going back to the issue that is not dealt with well enough or in full force, which is impunity. Especially the impunity enjoyed by the Myanmar military. There are still many countries that are dealing business and connecting or benefiting from the economic incentives and basically enabling the Myanmar military junta by extension. And that is prioritized over saving our lives, saving people's lives in Myanmar and in Cox's Bazar and Rohingya all across the world. And so we have this issue of priority not being, you know, placed on the right issues or on, you know, or morally seen almost. And so when we deal with issues of Rohingya, it's almost like we're actually just trying to kick down the doors that it would never open for us. And we have issues like this where, you know, dwindling funds are really an issue for the Bangladeshi government. And again, I may be critical of the management and the plans, but it needs to be said that Rohingya likelihood of actually repatriating is almost impossible at this moment in time, until unless the international community really comes together and find resolutions while also holding the Myanmar military accountable in the ways that uproot their, you know, or eradicate their power or influence over Myanmar. Without that, and without, you know, addressing the issues of lack of agency in the camps, without those issues addressed, we really won't be able to get anywhere, and the Rohingya situation will get even worse.
I see all three of you nodding, you know, seemingly in agreement there. But, Kiel, what exactly would you like the international community to do? Is it more money? Is it sanctions? Is it legal action? What can they do at this point in time?
Well, there are short-term and long-term strategy we need to have. In the short term, we need to build up the Rohingya community with education and the political support. Education is a very grassroots level, young people, you know, to have a formal education, and also adults have vocational trainings, so they can build up their life. And on the other hand, the second thing is political support. The Rohingya activists around the world, you know, even in Bangladesh camp as well, they need to get support from the international community for a large, stronger movement. That will make sure the repatriation of the community will be decided by the community, by the Rohingya community, when and how will be decided by the Rohingya community, not by the third country or not anyone, and not even by the Burmese military. Because this is the perpetrator. This is the criminal. They are not the partner of peace, not partner of the solution. They should be punished, they should be brought to justice. But it is not going to happen in short term. It will take long time. So we cannot put all our expectation and solution only on the legal matters. Legal matter is extremely important. It is crucial, it's very important. Transitional justice also very important. But we cannot rely entirely, all our movement and action depend on the legal matters. As you see, it takes several decades and several years. But for that time, a big, large community already has been affected and destroyed by the genocidal actions. How are we going to repair this? How are we going to make sure that this damage will immediately stop and turn over? So we need a short-term strategy to build up the community, to support the Rohingya people, Rohingya leaders for the political movement. And all the resources need to be channeled among the Rohingya people, because Rohingya people deserve to protect themselves, to decide their future, their destiny. Mm. So this is international community immediately need to do this.
Tom, we've seen recently the International Court of Justice ruled that the Gambia's genocide case against Myanmar can now proceed. Is that a huge turning point in terms of getting justice for these people?
Well, Tom, it's an important step forward. There's no question about it. And another important step forward happened yesterday when the UK joined the case. Now we have obviously the Gambia leading the case. We now have the Netherlands, Canada, and now the UK about to join the case. So both of those steps, the fact that it's going to proceed as a case and the fact that there's stronger support by nations are very important steps forward. But we need to do a lot more than just that. There is ways in which the international community can coordinate their actions, focus strategically the pressure that needs to be applied, diplomatic pressure, economic pressure, the boycott of weapons. We need to cut the flow of revenue to the military junta in Myanmar. Just think about this. The person who commanded the troops that committed the genocide 5 years ago is the one who led this coup in Myanmar last year and is now with his criminal gang, basically, is what you could accurately conceive of this, a criminal gang holding an entire nation of 54 million people hostage. It is critical, and literally torturing, killing, the daily life for the people in Myanmar is a living hell, and it's getting worse. The international community has failed to adequately respond to this crisis. It's failed to focus its energy and attention in a coordinated manner, and I think that needs to be on the agenda of every country who believes in human rights and justice. Otherwise, this nightmare is just going to get exponentially worse before our very eyes.
Yeah. We've got a few minutes left, and I'd like to hear from all three of you on this sort of final point. Yasmin, we'll start with you. How much hope do you hold out that one day the people that are stuck in these refugee camps will be able to return home to Myanmar? And what do you think it will take?
I think that it would take a lot of efforts, and as Special Rapporteur Andrews have mentioned, it would need a collaborative, coordinated effort from all sides and all parties involved on this to actually uplift the community. And first, it would have to start with recognition that Rohingya survival itself has been a skill set that is immeasurable by any means. And it needs to actually be acknowledged and utilized in terms of planning for the inevitable, which is however long Rohingya would need to stay within the Cox's Bazar refugee camps or other settlements around the world, that they should be able to use those skills to actually meet issues like food shortage or, you know, teach themselves, run educational system, do things that would actually sustain them for the time being until they actually go back to Myanmar. And hopefully they would go back as contributing members of the society. So I have a lot of hopes for my community. And I know that we've survived one of the worst things that could ever happen to humans. We would survive for the next however long it takes for us to gain back, you know, the peace and prosperity that we deserve. But it would need the international community to become serious about the issue and actually take efforts and actions toward that goal.
Thank you all so much for joining us. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Such a huge issue and so much to cover. But I'd like to thank all three of our guests today, Chua Nguyen, Yasmin Ulla and Tom Andrews. Thank you so much for being on the program. And thank you too so much for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Tom McRae, and the entire team here in Doha, bye for now.